Supervisors, please take your seats. If you are here, please check in. I'll call the meeting to order. And while people are doing that, I want to cover a couple things real quick. Roger, you're going to help to take care of coordinating the photographs, right? You've got an assistant that's going to help with that, and you can do individual ones too. What we'd like to do is one group photo like we always do, like you have in the back there. But for the website, we're also talking about an individual page for each county board member. And so it would be logical to have the same background, consistency for the website. And so what we were thinking is that the day that we do the group photograph, everybody probably would be dressed up anyway. That might be a good day to do the individual photographs. And kind of thinking budget day might be the logical time to do that. Does that sound? Arlene, we'll figure out a way to Photoshop you in or something. Oh, you'll be here for budget day? Were we going to do it October 21st? That's not budget day. But is budget day okay? Anybody not here on budget day? That'll be the Monday night, or probably better, the Tuesday morning, November 8th, 9th, whatever that day is. A couple people won't be here? November 8th and 9th. Okay. Well, we'll figure out a way to make it work, since we've got most people who are going to be here. And so if you can, we'll try to remind people as we get closer too, but if we can keep that in mind, so you wear whatever you want for that picture. Yeah, Tara.
Would it be worth asking if more people are going to be here on October?
How many people will not be here for the October 21st-ish meeting? Okay, we got a few hands for people who won't be here. All right, so yeah, I guess it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of another. All right, let's look at, Roger, that'll work for you, that November one? Right next to the flu shots. There you go. Probably better to get the picture first, because we don't want people crying for the photograph. So. Yeah, there you go. Okay, how are we doing? We have 29 board members present. That is a quorum. So let's continue. I'll call the meeting to order, and we'll continue with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, so we covered that. Real quickly, are there any supervisor conference reports? Seeing none? Good, that was quick. That's it for my report. Mr. O.
Okay, I have one proclamation and a couple of announcements. Proclamation October 2010, Solid Waste and Recycling Month, whereas dedicated nationally recognized county professionals help to minimize our county's impact on the environment by effectively managing waste through award-winning programs, and whereas La Crosse County Solid Waste programs in part include waste energy, permanent household hazardous materials collection, asphalt shingle recycling, treatment of petroleum-impacted soils, and trailer home recycling, and whereas in addition to these programs, La Crosse County facilitates local and regional collaborative efforts in managing waste through shared recycling newsletters, mobile collection of household hazardous materials, access to waste energy program, and solid waste planning. Whereas La Crosse County has shown its commitment to further enhancing solid waste and recycling efforts through sustainability practices, which will be coordinated by the county sustainability coordinator. And whereas residents benefit from the cost savings, improved service, and enhanced sustainability that result from intergovernmental collaboration on solid waste and recycling issues. And whereas all residents have an ongoing responsibility to participate in sustainability through decreasing the amount of garbage that is produced in our homes, schools, communities, and workplace by practicing waste reduction, recycling, and buying recycled products. Now, therefore, be it resolved, La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of October 2010 as La Crosse County Solid Waste and Recycling Month, and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of persons dedicated to the welfare of La Crosse County residents.
You did that pretty fast, but not with as much feeling as Marilyn Pedretti puts into hers. So that wasn't too bad, though,
that's
Steve.
That's not possible. It's just not.
Moved by Margaret Wood, seconded by Maureen Friedland. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.
The one additional announcement that I have is you may have seen an email that I sent out today. We're lucky enough to have the Seven Rivers Region Chapter of the SCAA, which are folks that are interested in helping reduce sudden cardiac arrest association. They're actually raising money for putting AEDs, automated defibrillators, in each one of our Sheriff's Patrol vehicles. I'm going to pass around a folder that if you can take a look at. There's a wine and food tasting event that's coming up on October 16th. If you're interested, there are tickets in this. Please return it to me, as well as raffle tickets that they're selling to raise money again for our Sheriff's Department to put AEDs in each one of the patrol vehicles as well. So that's going around. Please bring it back to me when I'm done. The Sheriff's Department, if you don't get any tonight, actually has both of these as well. I don't know if any of you saw that email that I sent out this morning. Okay, some of you did. Please encourage to buy. I'll be buying a number of raffle tickets, and it'll help benefit the Sheriff's Department. That's all I have.
Okay, next thing that we have on the agenda is a presentation. We have our guest speaker tonight, Todd Berry, and I am really pleased to be able to introduce Todd. I think many of you have had a chance to see him at various presentations that he's made, either recently here in La Crosse at the forum, the economic forum, the WCA events that he's been at, and so forth in the past. And he also spoke to the La Crosse Tribune editorial board this afternoon and my class over at the university, so I've seen some of the slides that he has. This is really, I consider this a coup to have Todd be willing to come to La Crosse to speak to our county board here tonight. He's going to talk a little bit about kind of the state of things as they are, and would certainly welcome any questions that you may have. And so I'm going to turn it over to Todd at this point, and thank you very much for coming to La Crosse, Todd.
It's a pleasure to be here. As I was telling Steve on the way over here, I have a loose family connection to La Crosse in that if you go on campus and look at Mitchell Hall, that is my mother-in-law's uncle, or my wife's great uncle, Rex Mitchell. So anyway, it's good to be here, I'm going to try to put La Crosse County in a couple contexts. One, in terms of the state economy. Second, in terms of the state's finances. And then third, a little bit of comparison regarding La Crosse County. And I handed out, and I hope everybody has one, this is something that we did earlier in the year that has two articles, one on county administration, county boards kind of stuff, and then at the back there's a shorter piece on county revenues and expenditures. And Steve didn't get to me fast enough, or I could have put his picture up here. A little bit about me and the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. I served on a county board between 1980 and 84. When my hair was a much different color and I had more of it.
So you were cured after 4 years, huh?
Well, it was a lot of things, but I will say it was a much happier time to be on the Dane County Board 20, 30 years ago than it is now. They don't play particularly nice in the sandbox. A little bit about the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. We're approaching our 80th year. Legally, we are a 501c3, which means we're akin to a foundation. We are nonprofit, nonpartisan. We are funded by a mix of individuals, firms, foundations, unions, local governments, school districts, and we also have an endowment, which helps. We also have a number of publications we sell, and we also have a small consulting practice. Not that we try to make money on it, but every once in a while somebody asks us to help them with a particular problem, and we've been doing some school district consolidation studies as of late. So let's go to the economy, if I can get this thing to work. There we go. This is an old chestnut. I call this the canary in the mine shaft, and if you've heard me speak, you've probably seen this slide. This is Wisconsin's per capita income relative to the U.S., and the railroad track there is the U.S. average, so we're below the U.S., and there have been three times in the last 100-plus years when we have dipped down lower than normal, and that would be the Depression in the 30s, the manufacturing recession of the early 80s, which I think people forget was a real killer for the state. I think, Representative Medeker, were you in the assembly then? That was not a happy time. And then finally, most recently, we've dipped about 6% below. And you can see that we sort of crawl our way back, and we probably will again, but it's a longer crawl back. When you talk about the economy to the person on the street, they care mainly about jobs and wages. So just a quickie on that. This is the cumulative job change both for the U.S. and Wisconsin, with the U.S. in blue and Wisconsin in red. So obviously Wisconsin tracks the country, although at a little lower rate, and did so through the first half of this decade. But what is telling, and the reason I threw this slide up, is you can see those two lines parting about middle of the decade. And in fact, Wisconsin literally stopping well before the rest of the country, while it was still growing and peaking, and dropping, we think, probably into recession 6 months to a year before the rest of the country. And if this is in this particular data or indicate anything, it's that we dropped deeper. And the other thing that's troubling is that our cumulative growth seems to be lagging the country more than it did, say, 10 years ago. It's not that we're not growing, we just aren't growing as fast. And here's the actual job data, June 07 to June 10. You can see we lost about 15% of our manufacturing jobs, about 75,000 jobs. Not quite as big a loss as in the 80s, but a pretty good hit. Of course, we have a much smaller manufacturing base now, too. Total job reduction, a little bit greater than the nation. And here are wages. This is the average wage per job. And again, it's Wisconsin compared to the nation. So if you go back into the late 60s, we were 3 to 4% below the national average, which is the normal story. I mean, we're not quite as well off as the rest of the country, and really haven't been for a long time. You can see that there's a big slide there, again, in the early mid-80s. And then things sort of even out and ratchet up and down, but it's we certainly aren't growing back toward the national average. And if anything, the trend line is slightly away from the national average. The lighter line there that's sort of hiding is GDP per worker. Now, what is that? It's output per worker. And economics would dictate that wages would follow productivity. So if the productivity per worker is dropping, then the earnings would reflect that. Okay, so we've talked about jobs and wages. Where are our jobs? And the reason I'm showing you this is because I'm trying to give you an idea of why the economy is behaving the way it is and the challenges we face, particularly with state finances. This is a list over the last 20 years of the industries where we disproportionately employ people. In other words, we just have a lot more people working in those industries than the rest of the country. And you'll see that almost all of them, if not all of them, are, well, almost all of them, are manufacturing. A lot of them are paper wood related or machinery related. And The first column is the percentage change in employment in those industries nationally. And what you'll see is that every one of those industries is losing employment nationally. And that's where we are strong. Now, the good news, bad news of this is, generally speaking, we are not declining as fast as the rest of the country. And in some cases, we've actually grown employment while the nation has lost it. So we're in industries where we are vulnerable, and if we're going to succeed to some degree, we have to swim against the tide. All of these industries, because we disproportionately employ people in them, means we are net exporters of goods and services in these industries to other states and countries. And that's a good thing. You want to be an exporter. Now, where our jobs are not, this is fastest job change in these categories, and it's really a hodgepodge. One of the notable examples there would be health-related stuff. There's a couple things that have to do with professional and business services, also important. And in every one of those, they're growing a lot nationally. In every one of those, we are growing too, although in many cases not quite as fast. But the key thing is we don't have many people in these industries. We disproportionately underemploy people. So we are a net importer in all these. And, of course, that doesn't create jobs and income from the state if we're having to net import. This is probably the most important fact that I've read in 5 or 10 years, at least. The Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City studies new firm creation and entrepreneurial activity. They're really the place. I mean, they're underwriting research, they're funding doctoral research, anything and everything to do with entrepreneurial activity. And this is from their publication last month. Startups and young companies dominate net job creation in the U.S. and have done so for the last 30 years. In fact, there is another quote from their publications that argues that net, every new job created in this country since 1980 has been created by a firm that is 5 years old or less. So, you know, we hear all the political candidates on both sides of the aisle talking about jobs, but they may not quite have their focus in the right place. So let's look at these new firms. The box at the top there is the new firms in Wisconsin as a percentage of all our businesses. And when you do that calculation and rank the states, we rank between the bottom 5 and 10 states. If you look at the employees that those firms have, in other words, new firm employees as a share of all employees, again, we tend to be lower. And we tend to rank in that bottom range of states. Now, that's somewhat not surprising because our employment is heavily concentrated in mature industries. These are the firm creation rates of various industries. You can see the arrow pointing down there. And the top two are construction and professional and business services. Third is information, IT, all that kind of stuff. You'll note that in those areas, we employ a smaller share of all the jobs than the U.S. does. We underemploy in those high firm-creating areas. And if you look down to, let's go back one. Saves the incompetent from his own self. Manufacturing, where we're obviously strong, has a fairly low firm creation rate. And you can see there we really disproportionately overemploy compared to the nation. We employ almost 20% of our workers in manufacturing compared to just a little bit over 11% for the U.S., We are now the state, the nation's number one manufacturing state. Yeah?
I don't know if you're going to take questions during your presentation.
If it's something that you really don't understand, I'm happy for you to ask questions. If you want to wait till the end, that's sometimes I find I answer the question in the next slide. But go ahead.
No, it goes back to your first presentation on the manufacturing part.
Yeah.
The industry in the state here.
Yeah. Well, you know
free
what
trade
that
came in about 1980.
Yeah.
And or is it because the manufacturers want to pay less and maybe ship their company overseas?
That slide is not saying that we lost manufacturers. What it's saying is that national.
Todd, I think your microphone went off. There's a button. Thanks, Gary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. What it's saying is that those are industries that are shedding employees. Now, it's important to understand the distinction here because you can have healthy manufacturing companies that are surviving global competition and continuing to operate here, and yet they can be shedding employees. And that is really what has been going on here, is that the way they're surviving is they're becoming very lean. I talked to somebody who owns a small engine company in the Fox River Valley, and he told me it's a family business, and he told me that the way they were able to compete with the Chinese is they were keeping no inventories, and they were manufacturing as they needed it, and they could beat the Chinese on transportation costs. And it's that kind of sort of clever dance that is making them survive.
Are those companies then putting high-tech machinery in place of manpower?
In some cases, yeah. I can tell you that I was in another large plant in the Valley that was a very familiar name a couple years ago. And it was sort of gritty and dirty on the outside, and you went in, and these huge assembly floors had been cleared, and they were computer operated, pretty highly sophisticated workstations, and you know there were skilled workers doing the manufacturing, but from fairly high tech workstations, and there again, I think they're competing with technology.
So you don't think that the fact that businesses were given stipends to go overseas and created, you know, a want to go someplace else for cheap labor, mm-hmm. you don't think that had an effect in Wisconsin?
Well, I know of firms that have done that, but if you've decided that your business model is going to be leaner, then and you're going to be more technologically oriented and more smart in the way you do your manufacturing, then the labor isn't as much of an issue. It's going to depend a little bit on the industry. As far as trade, and you know, I don't want to get into that too much, but about a third of the activity that has resulted from various trade agreements has been in agriculture. And that's one area where we tend to benefit. Prior to the early 90s, I think the tariff on U.S. goods into Mexico was 10%. And the U.S. tariff on Mexican goods was 2%. So when they wiped out the tariffs, our egg products just flowed into Canada and Mexico, where they before weren't able to. So, I mean, it's a very complicated mixed kind of question with, you know, data on both sides. So the economy obviously impacts the state. And so we've looked at the economy. It's very hard to compare states financially because their budgets are incomparable. But their financial statements can be compared because they're all prepared under the same generally accepted accounting principles or GAAP. And these numbers are pulled from the state's annual financial statements that come out of the controller's office. And you can see that the state's gap deficits have been growing for a number of years. And as of last December, it was minus $2.7 billion. I suspect when the number comes out for the fiscal year that's done, that that number will continue to grow, just because of all the maneuvering the state has done to try to keep its budget on paper in balance. Now, clearly we haven't done a very good job as a state of keeping our books in order. I think perhaps what is more telling is how we prepared or did not prepare for the recession. The top part of that slide. Okay, I guess. Aha. She's going to save me again. Can I go back? Yeah. Oh, thank you. What the top of this slide says by the surpluses is that in 2008, as we went into the recession, every state in the union except, I think, Arkansas had a bigger surplus, a bigger budget reserve than Wisconsin. So we were pretty naked going in. And the next column shows that the next year we still looked pretty naked. We were sitting on surpluses of 0 to 1% of what we spent. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a county or a school district that was like that. I mean, there are some, but I mean, I know the average for school districts is about 16%. Also, there was a lot of retrenchment in county in states, and what that second part of the slide says is, while most states were retrenching and trimming their budgets, we were not. 43 states were cutting their budgets, and we did not. And one way around that is we were one of the states that enacted major tax increases, corporate, individual, and tobacco. Of course, in dollar terms, New York and California, just because they're so huge, were much bigger than we were. I think other states in that list were North Carolina and Washington. So we weren't terribly well positioned going into the recession. And so what we ended up doing is pretty much what we've been doing for a long time. And I think it's interesting that both candidates for governor used the same exact phrase, which is, we've been kicking the can down the road. These are the structural deficits, and it's not a true deficit, but in effect what it is through taking money from the transportation fund or the medical malpractice fund or other funds, or through accounting tricks, or through promised increases in spending or reductions in taxes, we have, in all of our budgets for the last more than a decade, been putting ourselves in a position where we've made a lot of promises and commitments before we even begin to budget. And going into 2011, that commitment is now standing at about $1.4 billion. If they were to do nothing, and it would double, and that would be the number you see in the paper, $2.7 billion. I really don't like that number because I think it scares the public unduly, and two, I don't think it reflects the true size of the problem. I think a more accurate number is about $1.4 billion. You can see that's as tall a bar as any of those there, but again, going back well into the 90s, we were running structural imbalances of $500 to $600-700 million a year. So what does that mean? Well, tax collections for the state typically grow $400, $500, $600, $700 million a year. And what that means is in the first year of a two-year budget, you've already committed all the new revenue you're going to get in the first year. So they're always running a year behind. So we're always in a perpetual sort of budget crisis. And I'll tell you, if you were to map out the politics of that, you would find both parties controlling the governorship in that, and both parties controlling various combinations of the legislature. It's not a partisan thing. It's a more of just a universal dysfunction.
Todd, we got one question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Tara?
Yeah.
Can you help us understand the significant shift between the 0203 and 0405, that huge drop?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you back it up, Linda?
I don't know why it won't let me do this. I'll try to go back. Oh, maybe she'll get me back there. Okay. Why that? Okay. 2000-2001 is the prior recession. Tax revenues drop. They did the tobacco bonds then, so you get the spike. Then the economy starts to recover. You also do the transportation fund raid. and so it comes back down, and then we're sort of going along there in the $600-700 million range. The really bad news is in 2009, because when they passed that budget, the structural deficit was only $400 million. But when they saw the recession coming, instead of sort of battening down the hatches, they doubled the structural deficit. It went up to $800 million. And then, of course, the economy worsened, and so you'd expect, you know, those numbers to get worse as well. Part of the reason that red bar is as tall as it is federal stimulus money. And we have about $3.5 to $4 billion of new federal money flowing through the state treasury in this current biennium. Now, some of it is stimulus, some of it is other kinds of federal money, but it's paying for a significant part of the state's two largest programs, school aids and Medicaid. And you know, given the federal government's problems, that's probably not going to continue. Yes.
So, what would the bar be without that?
Without that? You know, it's hard to say, because if there weren't federal stimulus money, then you have to think about, well, what would the governor and the legislature have done? Would they have cut, or would they have looked for other one-time pots of money? It's hard to say. The history would say they'd look for one-time pots of money, but it certainly would be, I don't know off the top of my head, it might be half as high or three-quarters as high, something like that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mainly due to the school aids. I speak to a lot of school board people and superintendents as well, and one thing that I find in that community in particular is that there seems to be this notion, well, if the economy is coming back, then certainly the tax collections will come back and things will get better. And here's where the bad news comes. Things are not going to get better, and I'm going to show you the math. One thing, the State Department of Revenue has actually scaled back its estimates for the recovery at being a little bit slower and a little bit longer to occur in its last forecast. And the other, if this will come up, there we go. And this actually shows that this is the first column is their May forecast, then they redid it in their August forecast, and then you see the U.S. August forecast. What's the story here? Well, if you compare the first two, it's that in every case they lowered their estimate of how fast income was going to grow in the state. And then if you compare it with, and I'm having trouble seeing whether the computer's picking this up or not, but if you compare Wisconsin to the U.S., in every one of those years our incomes are predicted to grow at a slower rate. So the forecast has been scaled back, and we're not going to grow as fast as the rest of the country. Why do I show you this? Well, if I can get this to move, there we go. There's the, why do we care about this? Income growth is pretty much predictive of tax revenue growth, income and sales tax growth. So if it's going to be a little bit slower than previous forecasts or the rest of the country, then that means probably we're not going to see the same kind of revenue growth that we would like. I mean, typically, when things are sort of chugging along, we'll do 5 to 6%. So 4 4.5% isn't much. Now, ignore all the numbers and all the words. The story here is pretty simple, and that is if the economy grows a little faster than those forecasts, 4.5% income growth, and if that's how fast tax collections grew at the state level, we'd end up with about $1.5 billion of new money next year and the year after, just because the economy grows finally and tax collections come in. The problem is, and that's the arrow, the structural deficit, the things we've already promised and committed, is about equal to all the new money we're going to bring in the next budget. Remember I said this kick the can down the road phenomenon? Well, we've kicked the can down the road multiple years. So it's not going to be a very fun time to be in the legislature or governor. In fact, I told Steve's class, I think, I don't know why anybody would want to be governor. But, you know, maybe they're into, I don't know, self-punishment or something. looking forward, there are a couple key things. One is, what programs will drive the budget? In the 90s, it was prisons and it was school aids. In the first half of this decade, corrections, prisons stopped growing. Now it's just sort of up a little bit each year. School aids slowed in growth but continued to rise, but Medicaid took off. And this is not dollars, this is people. And so you can see that the number of people on Medicaid between 98 and 08 went from under 400 million to almost 400,000 to almost 1.1 million. Or put another way, we were covering about 1 in 13 people on Medicaid in 98. In an 08, we were covering 1 in 5. Remember, these data are before much of the recession, and this is because of law change, not because of economics as much, and not because of health care costs. And this has been rather bipartisan. The first run-up is Governor Thompson, and the second run-up is Governor Doyle. But the driver of the budget in the next session will definitely be Medicaid. Now, the good news is we're covering a higher percentage of people in terms of health insurance in this state than all but two or three states in the country, and this is part of the reason. The not-so-good news is we paid for it ourselves. And what's going to happen if the federal health care reform continues is a lot of other states are going to get a lot of federal money to do what we did with our own money. And so this is sort of classic Wisconsin. We tend to do things before other states, and then eventually the feds come along and bail out the laggards. And so we don't compete well for federal money because of that. On the revenue side, the normal places, I mean, they'll always look for fee increases. What legislators want to look for is fee and tax increases that will be under the radar or won't be controversial. And fee increases would certainly be in that area. And if you're looking for reasons why tuition on campuses has gone up, it's because you can shift cost onto students. Other rhetorical places that we've looked many times at tobacco over the last 10 to 15 years. And to be honest, we've squeezed every ounce out of the golden goose. There's nothing left to squeeze. The tax rate is now at a point of diminishing marginal returns. The people that were going to quit smoking have been squeezed out. The people that are continuing are more serious. And they can buy on the internet, they can run over to Winona or Rockford or deal with Aunt Betty. I tell a joke to audiences, and I will deny ever saying this, but if you're looking for a good way to make money or perhaps pull in a lot of money for county government, rent a semi. And in the middle of the night, only in the middle of the night, you can drive to St. Louis, where cigarettes are 17 cents a pack in tax. They're $2.52 here. You do the math. It's pretty good profit margin. Think about all the packages of cigarettes you can put in a semi. Drive it back in the dark, cross the border, pray that you aren't immediately seized by the Department of Revenue, and you've got a pretty good profit margin. But I don't tell that story for serious reasons, but simply to say that people that are going to continue to buy have options, and we aren't seeing the kind of revenue growth in tobacco that we used to. Now, the two other that I've listed there are sort of low-hanging fruit in the sense that rhetorically you can argue, well, we can increase taxes on business or we can increase taxes on high-income people, but we did that in the last budget. So there's not quite as much room to maneuver there. There's probably no room to maneuver on tobacco. Yeah.
And there's even though it isn't a big deal, the valuation of property has fallen a
yep.
little bit.
Yep.
And that doesn't help matters any either.
Well,
it won't help generate any new income when you lose $400
yeah.
of the value.
Now, of course, the property tax and taxation of properties is almost exclusively a local function in Wisconsin. There is a small amount that the state depends on, but percentage-wise, it's pretty small. But, I mean, it is a reflection of, you know, the underlying health of the real estate market and property. We've now had two consecutive years of property value drop, and I'm not so sure we're done yet. There might be another year. Now, to wrap this up, let's just talk a little bit about counties, and I'm sorry, these numbers are a little small. They're in the handout I gave you, but the column on the left just looks at county tax rates in 2009-10, and you can see these are all equalized value tax rates. You can see La Crosse County there, and the top five are up at the top group. Then there's a bunch of counties that we just somewhat randomly, somewhat methodically picked out as possible comparables to La Crosse given size, population, and then the bottom five are also shown there. And of course, ones in the bottom five tend in part to be low rate just because they're so high value. I mean, Dane is very high value. Well, they're either suburban counties or they're resort counties. And you can see there's La Crosse sitting in the middle, but actually below the middle. On the right is just the same thing done on a per capita basis. Sometimes only looking at tax rates can be a little bit misleading simply because of property values. And you can see there that La Crosse is actually a little bit lower in the rankings. It's in the bottom five compared to the ones above it. So that's two ways to look at property taxes. Let's see if we can get this. There we go. And here are some spending categories. This gets a little problematic. We used to publish data on county spending per capita annually, and county folks got so mad at us that we just decided it wasn't worth it, which is too bad because it is useful data if you take it with a grain of salt. And what they were griping about is that, you know, some spending programs are funded with their own money plus state money plus federal money, and they didn't like to look at the spending side per capita. They didn't think it was representational. My comeback to that would always be, well, if one of those revenue sources dries up, you are going to have to decide what to do. So on the left is sort of a macro operating and capital expenditures per capita. You can see there's La Crosse on the left side underlined in the bottom five. On the right is general government, meaning, funding for the county board, the administrator, the kind of general administrative functions. And there again, La Crosse is in that, is lower than I think all of its comparables and toward the lower end of the distribution, and there's La Crosse. And I think this is the last slide. This is public safety per capita, and you're right in the middle of the comparables and the state. And then finally is human services, which, as you know, is a big part of county budgets, about half or more. And there's La Crosse on the lower end of its comparables, and on the lower end, but not the absolute bottom of all the counties in the state. Now, I can't remember if I have... No, that's it. So thank you for being so attentive, or at least not snoring. And I'd be happy to go back to any slides and answer any questions.
Questions anybody has? Ralph Geary.
Thank you. You had that slide where you showed the workers in Wisconsin mm-hmm. get paid less than the U.S. workers?
Average wage, yeah.
Okay, how do the workers in La Crosse compare to the state wages?
Yeah. I could look that up. I don't know off the top of my head. The feds do publish wage data for certain metro areas. I can give you sort of one unrelated comment, but it's the only thing that's even somewhat relevant that I have in my head at the moment, and that is I know when we – I gave a speech in Eau Claire last year, and we looked at income growth for the larger Eau Claire area compared to the state in recent years. And that area of the state was performing somewhat better than the entire state, given that, you're below them and on the river. Now, of course, they're near the cities, but it wouldn't surprise me if you were performing at least as well or above the state average. I think your property value declines in this part of the state have been less than in other parts of the state, which suggests the same thing. But
okay.
if you want, I can get that for you.
Sure.
Yeah.
The other one, I've been getting this Wisconsin taxpayers for quite mm-hmm. a few years, and if you grabbed one of these and compared it with 20 years ago, my recollection is the counties you show at the top for spending or taxes are the same they were 20 years ago, and the ones you show at the bottom. Mm-hmm. Is there some phenomenon that
well,
occurs?
In a lot of this stuff, history matters. The kind of county you are, the kind of population you have, the kind of political climate you have. I mean, you tend to behave in a certain way over a long period of time, so that doesn't surprise me. I can tell you though that I can think of examples with states where you've had some pretty dramatic movements in states in terms of, say, taxation or expenditures. South Dakota, for instance, used to be fairly high taxing, fairly high spending, and has now gone to the bottom. Ohio used to be pretty much near the bottom, Nebraska too, and they've moved the other way. So if you look at it over 40 or 50 years, it is possible to move. That's going to probably be less likely with counties, but you definitely have two Wisconsins going on, and we have for a long time. You have all the population growth and income growth occurring in about 14 counties that are in like a U or a V that run down from Green Bay through the valley into the Milwaukee suburbs, leapfrog to Madison, leapfrog to St. Croix, Pierce, Polk counties, sort of a V. Outside of that, the economic performance is much slower. It's those urban, suburban counties that were really going. Now, that's not to say La Crosse isn't doing okay, but we were looking for the real, hot counties.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you comment on shared revenues? Because I think that's going to be a big deal.
Yeah.
Kind of the history, why they do it, the past, where we are now, your prognostication
sure.
for the short future, and then a little bit on the formula and how that sets up.
Okay. We'll try to do that in half an hour. I think I can do it in a minute or two. The history of shared revenue is that the property tax is the tax people have always loved to hate in this state. And one of the attempts to try to get it down came when we were the first state to create an income tax in 1911. And the original plan was that 90% of that money would be returned to the community or county from when where it came. It was returned to origin. That didn't last too long. State government started to get ambitious in terms of programming and expenditures, and by 1925, that 90% had dropped to 50, and it hasn't improved since. The next key point was in the early 70s. The return to origin system was thrown out, and instead we went to a shared revenue formula that was property value based, like the school aid formula, with some wrinkles. So if you were a property rich county or municipality, you would get less. If you were property poor, you would get more. Now, in 1994, all that sort of came to a screeching halt because the governor and legislature, in a bipartisan, what I think I called in a speech to counties association there, cliff jump, decided that they were going to promise to fund two-thirds of the cost of schools. Now, that was sort of an artifice. It really wasn't two-thirds, but we'll leave it there. One of the fallouts of that was shared revenue got frozen. And then subsequently, one of the things that was going on is though the appropriation was frozen, it was still based on property value. So you could have rearrangement of aid within the formula, and some counties were winners and some were losers. And eventually there was an amendment, I think in a state budget, that basically said we're freezing the appropriations, and if we increase them, we're going to increase them at a standard percent. But then in this past budget, the shared revenue appropriation was cut again, and school aids were too this time around. So I don't see anything changing. Medicaid, the huge structural deficit, the pressures from Medicaid cause a problem. Then probably next in line come the school districts, and then everybody else, takes a number and sits at the back of the line, and that means the university, tech colleges, shared revenue recipients, and so forth. So I can't really give you a very sanguine outlook.
So in other words, you would not bet a lot of money that we'll get. If we stay the same with shared revenues, we'll probably be lucky, and
yeah,
you'd not be surprised if we see a drop.
If I were budgeting, I would probably budget a drop. And the reason simply is when you, the thing about the Wisconsin state budget that the public doesn't realize is that the Wisconsin state budget is not about the state. Because you 55 to 60% of all the money that's being spent is simply going to counties, municipalities, school districts, tech colleges. And when you add Medicaid to that, and you add the university and corrections to that, you've got 80% of the budget. And so if you've got a big problem, as they did in this past budget, they gotta go where the ducks are. And the big appropriations tend to be where you mathematically have to go. So, and there's, I would also argue that there's more of a political constituency for Medicaid or school aids in particular.
I thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry for all the great news.
Yeah, we're all ready to jump off the cliff now. Thanks, yeah. Todd. Don.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said something that I'm not sure if I quite agree with you.
Well, you don't have to.
You said during the last part of your presentation that a few years ago, jails were the big issue, mm-hmm, and expenditure for counties.
Oh, no.
No, state.
State.
For the state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, okay, I see. Okay, you're talking about the state, and I was looking at it from the county,
okay,
because 6, 7, 8 years ago, I was on a few committees at the state level, and 52 counties at that time were remodeling,
yep,
revamping, or building brand new.
Yep.
Now, those 52 counties take a lot of money out of the system, and the system isn't going to correct itself until we start paying some of those off. Mm-hmm. And that's 8-10 years down the road. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. we're just about ready to open a new one here for a second time in 13 years.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it can't continue to go that way because counties can't afford a new jail every 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
But we aren't going to correct very much because we have to pay that off over a 10 or 12-year period, depending on...
Don, do you have a question there somewhere?
Yeah. Well, the question was, I think jails have a bigger impact than you are letting... Because we're paying those. The mm-hmm. county's paying it. The state isn't paying for the jails.
Yeah.
And well, the second mm-hmm. part is 6-7 years ago, we did research on poverty level in La Crosse County.
Mm-hmm.
We were below the state average at 7%.
Mm-hmm.
4 or 5 years later, we did another research, which was 3-4 years ago, and we fell to 11% below the state average. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking for somebody to give us a new version mm-hmm. as to where we stand today, but we fell from 7 to 11%. So we are attracting a lot of people who don't have a lot of money, and we can't supply good-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's really that is to some degree a Wisconsin challenge. I really was talking mainly about the state and what was going on in the 90s. And I would really commend to you, and if you go on our website, you can request a copy. We did a study comparing corrections in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and there's way too much in there to go over, but there are some things about Wisconsin that made us the way we are. We probably have more police, law enforcement, relative to our population than, and this is controversial to say, than we would need if you compare us to other states. We're in the top 10, 15 states. We are arresting people at a much higher rate than Minnesota. And then we are incarcerating them, of course, whereas Minnesota has other options. The thing that really drove the prison era in the 90s was a couple things. One, and all the women in the room can stand up and take a bow, is males, you know, 16 to 24, 25, do a lot of the crime. And we were in a baby boom echo in that period, and we were producing more of those people. Now we're on the back side of that, and crime rates are dropping here. And we remain a pretty low crime rate state. But we did not have enough beds in that era. At the same time, the state was deciding to get tougher. And so we had to build to reflect the change in law and the lack of beds. And to some degree, I guess that, you know, would explain the counties, too. They're playing catch-up. The other thing that was going on that surprised me, and it really helped explain all this, is we didn't pardon many people during the 90s. Our pardon rates went way down. And, you know, there are a lot, you can probably come up with a lot of different reasons, but certainly one of them is we had some really sensational crimes in this state in the early 90s. And I can remember some polling data where there were a couple times when crime was listed as the number one issue in the state. And it had nothing to do with crime rates. It was just a couple, you know, headlines and news stories. So.
John Menninger.
Yeah, just maybe a theoretical question.
Yeah.
You know, local government's nonpartisan. Most local governments, whether it's school district, county, cities, have substantial, I think Mr. Malley calls them fund balances.
Mm-hmm.
Surplus is a dirty word. And rainy day funds or whatever. And you might remember back when we had a $1 billion surplus under Marty Schreiber and Pat Lucey.
Mm-hmm.
And Lee Dreyfus ran for governor saying they stole the money, they overtaxed you.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to give it all back.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, anybody talks about building up a rainy day fund down in Madison or a surplus,
mm-hmm.
you're accused of overtaxing.
Yeah.
So are you ever going to get to the position in Madison where you both political parties think it makes some sense to have some rainy day fund?
Yeah, I think if there was a – I don't think it's a political problem anymore. I think there's enough time has passed that the folks with with memories of that look like me and you. You know, we've had more than a political generation pass. It's sort of like about once every generation you have a series of capital scandals, you know, and then everybody's chastised for a while and there's no news, and then a whole new generation comes along and then we have some more capital scandals. I think the memories of that are pretty dim. The problem is they've budgeted on the edge for so long, and they're always inheriting these structural problems that they're always behind the eight ball. What has changed, I think it's interesting that Representative Gottlieb, who's a Republican former mayor from Port Washington, has a constitutional amendment that is basically going to force some rainy day funding. And, you know, I suppose we can argue about whether it's the right approach or the wrong approach, but, you know, he's gotten some reasonable press on this, and I think the political climate has to some degree changed. I sat on a Ledge Council committee in 2002 that made a whole series of recommendations on fiscal management, and there was quite a bit of agreement in the committee, you know, legislators on both sides of the aisle. I think Bob Jauch was a co-chair, and Don Frisky, you know, Republican Democrat. We've put ourselves again behind this eight ball fiscally that we can never seem to get things back into equilibrium. You know, most budget experts for states say you should have a 5% reserve, and as I mentioned, school boards tend to hold much bigger balances, and I haven't looked at counties in quite a while. It used to be the counties had even bigger balances. Yeah.
All right.
Now, you know, we can argue over what the right amount is, but I don't think anybody can argue that given Wisconsin's economic makeup and the cyclicality of our economy, that we don't need some way to carve off the tops of the peak and save some for the bottom. And by the way, most states had rainy day fund balances that were pretty darn big. The average state balance in 08 was 8 to 9%. Yeah, there were.
Terry Johnson.
Yeah. Just, thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. Is the term structural deficit something different than real deficit?
Yeah.
And can you explain
sure.
that quickly, please?
When you hear the term deficit, it can be about several kinds of budgets, and it can be about something that isn't a deficit at all. Let's sort of start with one. When the governor and the legislature talk about a budget deficit, they're talking about whether the general fund budget, where all the taxes go and all the big programs tend to be, whether the revenues and expenditures equal each other. And if the revenues are lower, then you have a deficit. And that's the way most people would think about a deficit. The problem is what they've been doing is they'll take money from other places and move it around to create temporary revenue so that on paper it's balanced, but in reality it's not. But that's the standard notion of budget deficit. Now, and that is sort of in current time. Looking back, if you look at state financial statements, you know, the budget is over, they close the books, they do the math, and they look at the revenues and expenditures as a CPA would look at them, and I apologize for the green eye shade, but they look on it as a accrual basis rather than a cash basis. Then that tends to rearrange things a little bit and tends to force out the tricks and the gimmicks, and then you have a deficit on our financial statements, and that, you know, that's a true deficit too. The revenues were less than the expenditures, but it is a deficit based on generally accepted accounting principles, accrual as opposed to cash. So you've got, you know, the state budget in present time, looking back, the GPR budget. The structural deficit is really an unfortunate term. It's better to call it a structural imbalance or unfunded advance commitments or promises, because when you take money from the transportation fund or get money from the feds, and you can, and you only do that on a one-time basis, you're creating a potential hole in the next budget if you've paid for ongoing programming with one-time money. And that's one contributor to a structural deficit. If you do a little accounting trick, and there's a particular item in the budget where you can spend the money in 1 year and not have to budget until the next, that creates a structural imbalance. And then finally, if you create some kind of program commitment or promise some kind of tax cut, either a spending increase or a tax cut, in sometime in the future, you know, phase something in, that creates a future promise as well. So the structural deficit is certainly future budget pressure, but whether it's a deficit or not remains unclear. Okay.
That was very helpful. Other questions?
I hope.
Ralph Geary.
Back to that average income in Wisconsin is lower than the national average.
Mm-hmm.
How's the taxes in Wisconsin compared to the national average?
Yeah. The per capita, that was per capita income, Wisconsin versus U.S.
Yeah.
There are two ways that usually taxes get compared by the Census Bureau. One is relative to population per capita. And if I recall, I think we're about 18th on that measure. The other way is relative to the income of the state, and there we're 13th. And these numbers are for 08. The feds are always a couple years behind in releasing data. So those would be the sort of the two rank numbers. Now, when you get below the surface, what you find is that on some we're low and on some are high. And when people complain about taxes in Wisconsin, they're not really complaining about these ranks, I don't think. Most people don't even know what they are. What they are focusing on is income and sales tax, income and property taxes. If you do survey work and ask people which tax they like or they don't like, it's always the same. They hate the property tax the most. Why? Because they pay it in one or two lump sums. They hate the income tax almost as much, again, because they know what they're paying, even if they have withholding. Sales tax, they don't have any idea what they're paying, and they like the sales tax. I've seen some statewide survey data that is pretty surprising because it goes against all the normal academic kind of thinking. If you ask people what is the fairest tax and the most understandable tax in Wisconsin, they overwhelmingly say the sales tax. And of course, economists wouldn't view it that way. So it's the property tax where relative to income we're like 8th or 9th, and the income tax we're about 12th, and in both cases we're 20-25% above the average. Sales tax we're in the 30s, and we're probably about 10% below.
One other one, you said the state was trying to correct their problem by they increased taxes, I guess, on high-end earners and
mm-hmm.
something
mm-hmm.
else. But high-end earners have a lot of mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Do they move to a different state?
Well, I mean, they certainly can. We looked at some census data for the last census where they literally could tell by tax return where somebody lived in at 1 year and where they lived in the next year. And age-wise, you tended to see people leave the state in their 20s and in their 50s, 60s. You saw people coming in their 30s and 40s with their kids. So, I mean, it's partly an age thing. But when you looked at income, you did find that there was a higher rate of exit, not dramatically so, but there was a higher rate of leaving as income went up. And particularly when you looked at retirees, you could see there was something going on there because the migration rates to Florida were, of course, much higher than some other states. Now, if it were weather, you'd think, well, then the migration rate to Arizona, for instance, should be in the ballpark. It turns out they're double in Florida what they are in Arizona. And one reason is Florida has no income tax Arizona has an income tax. And in fact, Arizona's migration rate to Arizona was about the same as Wisconsin to Illinois. So, but that's about the only thing that I'm aware of that tries to deal. There's not a lot of good data on this.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, sir. Again, I'll put on your prognosticator hat. How will it take a one-term governor who just goes and slashes to get it back in balance, or, yeah, or where's the solution, yeah, to get back into balance?
Well, the challenge is that since the mid-90s, you know, the trajectory we were on promising people things was going like this, and the revenues were matching it. And then the economy started slowing, and this billion-dollar gap opened up, and we've really never closed that gap. We continued to do promise things and give things, but the revenues stopped. So we have this gap, and you know, there's two ways to close it. You can create more revenue, or you can cut expenditures. And that's a political decision. But the important thing, regardless of the option you prefer, is you have got to get the revenues and the expenditures to match and on the same trend line, and we haven't done that for 10 to 15 years. We generated enough new tax revenue in the last budget that if we had been really austere, we could have brought the two back together. Now, of course, it's even worse. If somebody's really, you know, exhibiting leadership, and they're going to have to do things that are going to be very unpopular, and the reason we've had this problem is politically the legislature and governors don't want to cut spending and they don't want to raise taxes. Well, that's the dilemma, and I know if I happened to be governor, I would just say, you know, I'm going to do what has to be done to get the long-term trajectory right again, and then suffer the consequences. I don't know. I think people are pretty smart that they understand if the time is spent to talk about it, that things have been rather out of whack for quite a while. So,
Margaret Wood.
Thank you. We haven't talked too much about the corporate tax situation. Mm-hmm. In the downturn of the economy, do we have any numbers about, you know, how many corporations we had at a certain point, how many of them went out of business, mm-hmm, and how many of them went out of state?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let me answer that in a couple ways. First, just to talk about the corporate income tax. That is a very volatile tax. In the early part of a recovery, in fact, we're already seeing it, the corporate income tax will start to rise at a pretty good clip before the individual income tax and the sales tax. It will also drop, and much deeper, early on in a downturn. So you get these big swings. The sales tax tends to do this by comparison. So it's a very volatile tax. I mean, the peaks and valleys can go from $400 million to $900 million or $600 million to $800 million. They're big. It's very volatile. And it reflects the fact that most businesses don't pay corporate income taxes anymore. They pay individual income taxes because they're partnerships or sub-S corporations or whatever. So the ones that are paying it are large, mainline, long-standing C corporations, the big names you would think. And they tend to be old manufacturing companies, and their profits go up and down with the economy. Now, you asked loss of... Let me tell you what I know, and it may not answer your question, but we've done a fair amount of work looking at firm creation and firm expiration. And what... I don't think I showed you this slide, but between 2000 and 2005, we grew the number of private business establishments in this state at a pretty good rate, and a rate faster than the country and every state around us. So 00 to 05, relatively good. When you look at the data for 05 to 09, and I think part of this is the fact that we went into recession sooner, we lost private business establishments while the country still gained and every state around us still gained. So now, did those go out of business? Did they go somewhere else? Don't know. You can't see that from the economic data. But we went through a period of creating more. Now we've gone through a period of net losing for the last 4 to 5 years. And that's why I threw up that new firm data, because clearly we have to create new firms.
Any other questions? Chuck Spiker.
The latest thing now, and I found out today in the paper, it's not the latest thing, is a two-tier pay system. Mm-hmm. Harley-Davidson in Milwaukee started it out. Kohler Company now is going to it. Send a 16-page reason why they want to do it. Mm-hmm. But I learned today it's nothing new. It's been on for 20 years. Mm-hmm. As the economy gets better, then they eliminate the two-tier wage system. Mm-hmm. How do you think, and the economy is probably going to recover much slower than it normally
well,
years ago.
If you're a large employer and you're not quite sure where the economy is going, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to run people on overtime. You're going to get as much out of the people that you've got because you don't want to commit to spending new money until you have some sense of whether the economy's on some track that's sustainable. And then the next thing you do if you have a wage structure like this is you would hire second-tier people. I think there's things in contract language that they're paid less, but that they don't have the job security either. And again, if you don't know what's coming and you've exhausted your overtime, you're probably going to go there. And then when the economy becomes more clear and you know where your business is heading, then you're probably going to add permanent employees on a permanent basis. I as you were talking, I was thinking, we do that in our tiny little nonprofit. We're staffed to some level, and through thick and thin, we stay at that level. But there have been times, we don't lay off in downtimes, although we had a person leave and we left the position vacant. But we've had some times where, because of our consulting with local governments and schools and stuff, all of a sudden we've gotten hit with work. And we went out and would hire former employees or former state tax officials or whatever to help us with the extra work. So in effect, we were sort of doing the same thing in a different way. We were keeping this employment flat and then trying to adapt to, to the variance.
But one thing, Harley-Davidson threatened to move.
Yeah.
Kohler says their letter that we're not interested in moving, we're not trying to upset the community, but it's unsustainable for us to go at this level that we're going at now. It's going to be interesting to see what does happen.
Yeah. These are these old line manufacturing companies that were on the list that you see in those sectors that are clearly economically stressed. Nationally, they're losing a lot of employment. And so if you're trying to compete in those industries, I guess, you have a couple options. You can keep the employees and try to get your wage costs down, or you have fewer employees and pay them more and up your technology. I'm not an expert on this area.
I've got a question. In the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this weekend, there was a story about that study about Milwaukee County, and one of the things that they're talking about that maybe should be considered is Milwaukee County actually filing bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What would you think would be the reverberation of something like that happening?
Well, MPS, the public schools, may be actually ahead of them. MPS has a huge unfunded post-retirement liability, like $2.5 billion, and it's losing enrollment every year. I heard a presentation from this group on this subject a couple weeks ago, and the county situation isn't as gargantuan as the schools, but it's, you know, it's in the billion plus category. And it's, you know, in both cases, this has been coming little by little for a very long time. My own view is we better get a municipal bankruptcy law. We don't have one. And if you have any access to your, you know, associations, colleagues, whatever, I would say there's some smart people better figure out how to draft a municipal bankruptcy law, because, I mean, the whole GM meltdown was painful and awful and everything, but there was a way to for it to happen and for us to put it in the past. And if this were to happen to MPS, as things stand now, we wouldn't have any way to get out from under this. And ditto for the county. You know, we've got some tiny rural school districts with very small enrollments that are under stress just because they're so small. And there again, we, you know, there's been talk of some of those going out of business, yet we don't have any way for a municipality in the state to go bankrupt. And I think we need to do something about that.
Any last questions? We should probably wrap up pretty quick. Anybody else have any? All right. Todd, thank you very much. That was very informative. All right, let's continue with the agenda here, and as if Todd didn't depress us enough, we have the county budget that we can talk about for a couple minutes.
Yeah, and it will just be a couple minutes, but I do want to bring you up to date on some status. We've got some new information for you. Try not to depress you any more than Todd has, but I'm always fascinated to hear his presentations. He's got such a great handle on data statewide and on the challenges before our entire state, but also the comparisons on county data. So I appreciate him bringing that. Yeah, if you could pass that out.
I think it went around.
What I have, just briefly, again, because I knew his presentation was going to be a little bit longer, so you can take a breather. We're not going to do a lot of work tonight unless you insist. So we're just going to walk through a number of things to bring you up to date on, including the handout that we gave you. Let's see here.
I don't know that answer.
Obviously, we continue to be in the same situation. All the analysis that I talked about still indicates that the best strategy for us is to hold our operating levy at zero, because we would be right up against the mill rate limit very shortly. Obviously, the biggest contingency with that is the relationship with our employees. We continue to work with them, and we'll be reporting to you hopefully in the next few months to let you know how that strategy is going. The second piece is that I continue to believe that our best strategy is the one-year strategy to preserve options for 2012. One of the reasons that the first bullet point there is to do as little harm as possible, future cuts should be tied to specific program aids. The reason that I point that out is in order to gain cooperation from our bargaining units, we can't be kind of having employees look over their shoulders of what we're going to do within the next year. We need to work with them. They need to know strategically that we care about the services that we provide, but that we can't be in a position that our wage and benefits escalate the problem in any more difficulty, because we don't have a perfect crystal ball on what the state is going to do. We do know so far that a number of state agencies are projecting about a 10% cut. That's what Governor Doyle has asked them to do. We've identified already some impacts in child support that we'll be talking about with executive committee. But again, I believe that at least through most of 2011, we should be all right with that. Again, I don't have a perfect crystal ball. A lot of it depends on what the new governor actually presents, because all we know are what the state agencies are putting together. We also believe that at least preliminary. The projections on highway revenues will be fine, maybe a slight uptick, but we're not going to count on that. We're going to actually see, because we do well in the highway formula. So again, that information is trickling in as we go along, but we won't really know until the new governor is elected and produces a budget in February. our challenge is to make sure that we don't make the challenge any greater. We don't increase spending in particular areas. We don't increase the cost of wage and benefits in areas. We get ourselves through into next year because, again, it's going to be the first 6 months of their biennium. And based on most historical data, in most times, the state has always tended to want to push the cuts on counties and cities into the next part of the biennium. So they tend to minimize the impact in the first 6 months of their biennium, the final 6 months of our calendar year, because it overlaps. They could obviously change that, but again, I'm just basing it on history and the last several deficits. We continue to now have a sign-up program for voluntary unpaid leave instead of forcing furloughs. There will be management positions and open position cuts. Those resolutions will come through the October 26th Executive Committee resolution, and we are starting a formalized review of all vacancies. All employee units outside of Human Services, who was already doing this, are doing a formalized position vacancy review that will come to Personnel and Finance and myself to review whether or not to go ahead and fill those positions. We have got to develop a new process also for both of the nursing homes, but that's a little bit more complicated, and we'll be working on that as well. But we're starting to get in preparation for where you can end up with attrition and other types of consolidation, provide for additional position savings beyond what we're actually projecting in 2011. In the budget. We continue to engage with employees on their budget saving ideas. We've worked with department heads and we'll continue to work with managers, and we'll get back to our employee groups talking about which ones we think we can work out, which ones will take more time, which ones we just have a policy disagreement with them on, and we'll continue to work through that. So I think we've got a good foundation of how to work into 2011. Just to remind you of the issues that we've got coming up, additional debt refinancing later on this week. We'll be examining all the options with existing debt that we've got for the LEC trust fund loans, the Hillview Assisted Living Facility. Some positive news there that we'll be able to really decrease the cost of actual funding debt if you choose to award that bid on Thursday. There will be a resolution that will come to you from Aging and Long-Term Care that will talk both about the bids as well as the debt service budget and how we would proceed there. You could choose to cut non-mandated services. I've gotten input from a couple of board members that want to zero in on historical societies and economic development. Bill, I got your email, so I'll be following up with you with a written motion to see if that reflects what you wanted to do. There will also be a detail packet that will go to all board members, giving the history of a number of the outside agencies that are funded in that and give you a lot of background, so all board members are dealing with the same information. Supervisor Ebert, you asked about historical societies. I'll draft that so that you can verify that would be the motion that you wanted to make, if I understand the memo that you just gave me. So we'll continue to work with each of you. Those are two supervisors that actually brought up individual suggestions. This week, of course, we've started our budget review with all committees. We're through some of the committees. Obviously, tomorrow we have Judiciary and Law and Health and Human Services, and finally, Exec, dealing with the committees. Departments of responsibility, those that report to each of those committees, that's where we've zeroed in on. And then, of course, October 26th will be the Executive Committee doing their main wrap-up on all of the budget and budget issues that are there. So we're working through these. One item that was identified by Supervisor Manti was wanting to utilize some of the revenue that the county made of land sales around Lake Neshonoc. So you'll notice in the capital improvements budget, Dennis, that the Lake Neshonoc, some improvements are being used directly there by using those fund balances that were reserved for that purpose. And of course, I've given you a detail on the blue sheet, which talks about places where we've used judiciously fund balance. So that's giving you an overall, each one of the assumptions that we've made continue to bear fruit. And tonight I want to touch on a couple of quick things. We may need to consider changes in fund balance and reserve policies in the future, although I'm not expecting any major recommendation on that. I know that will be an ongoing debate, but not for 2011 in my recommendation. And probably over time, a higher attention to increased fees or other revenue, particularly we continue to have debate and discussion about indirect charges to get closer to full cost. So that's the area I want to spend some time on. I did talk about this, and we will be zeroing in on these upcoming debt decisions. I'm not going to go over that slide again because you will get more information. And as follows, it's the same schedule. We did the bid opening for Hillview Assisted Living last week. That resolution went to the Aging Long-Term Care Committee. If you choose to act on the resolution, that will be on your October 21st. That will give us a final direction how to handle the budget or debt issues with that. And that initial resolution then on all debt, reflective of County Board action, will go to the October 26th executive meeting, then to the November 1st County Board resolution, which is calling for the sale of bonds for the various purposes that you would issue those bonds. And then, of course, the sale of bonds would be December 6th. So this is all timely based on the lowest interest rates we've seen in a long time, looking for the maximum amount of savings that may help us reduce the debt levy. Remember, we're raising the debt levy because of the law enforcement center, but with some of these changes, we may be able to reduce that a little bit, and that's what I want to bring you are some ways to save an additional levy below the recommended administrator's budget. So we're still looking for additional savings in those areas that should benefit us.
See, isn't this the time of year when we start to get in some of the new numbers, like the health insurance and those things, and some numbers from the state and so forth? Have those any of those come in yet? Are we getting any surprises?
I mentioned a couple of those that we know about with budget impacts. The health insurance renewal will be later on this week, so we'll be seeing what those numbers are. But again, based on experience that we've seen being self-insured, I think we're going to be in a very positive position, again, based on actual losses this year. So I believe we'll be able to hit the mark budgetarily on health insurance.
Okay. Any questions for Steve? Okay.
Okay, so the next two slides I want to spend a bit more time on is you have, at the earliest point ever, we've given you the detailed comparison of fees and charges. And again, you're not going to be asked to vote on this evening. I just want to give you an overview so as you're reviewing this. What we've usually done then is in November, we bring this attached to a resolution after the executive committee reviews this, which is all fees and charges throughout the county organization. As you're reviewing that, if you haven't had enough chance to read this, I just wanted to give you kind of the initials and what they mean. When you see a column that says SS, that means that the fee or charge is set by state law, state statute, or administrative rule. We don't get to set that amount. It's set by the state. We just try to estimate as accurately as possible the number of units of fees or service that we'd be charged for. When you see SC, it's set by the county. That's a decision that you can make. Whatever that dollar amount is, it's got to have some reasonable connection to the true cost of providing that service. You can't set it unreasonably, but you have the authority to be able to set it. SB means that it's set in some combination by both. It may involve a state surcharge. It may involve a decision that you're able to do. But what we've tried to do is identify most of those things, and I'm going to hit the highlights right now rather than go through every page unless you'd like me to. Specifically, if you'll notice, a lot of the fees did not change. You'll see N/C. We weren't very aggressive in our fees and charges this year. I made the judgment call that if we were able to do that without drastically changing fees and charges, that we might have more option in the next year if you felt more comfortable with larger fees and changes, with a couple of exceptions. Indirect charges, we are increasing a bit. You've seen that list. That will generate about $180,000 worth of additional revenue to our bottom line, and we'll go through some of the details of that. A couple of supervisors have asked detailed questions about that. We're going back through individual line items and reexamining a couple of those, and if I make some recommendations, the executive committee may want to consider some of those, or you may consider that in debate. In addition to that, in Register of Deeds, if you look at that, one of the largest increased items in revenue is offset completely by expenses. So in this case, SS means Social Security. Social Security redaction is a mandate that's required by the state, but luckily they give us a revenue to pay for that. We're able to charge for that. It's an increase in revenue of about $125,000 in that budget, but almost entirely spent just on redacting Social Security numbers from real estate documents. So while it looks like a big increase in revenue, it's spent immediately on that purpose. So it doesn't help our bottom line any, but at least we didn't have to raise property taxes or decrease our revenue from Register of Deeds in another place to actually accomplish that mandate. And obviously in the interest of protecting people's privacy and those types of things, we of course support that. But it's a zero gain, even though if you go to their line item on their Register of Deeds budget, it'll look like we saw a big increase in revenue. No, it's completely offset by an expenditure line item. Mr. Chair, I saw a hand out there, I believe.
Jeff Schrader.
Thank you, Steve. You said SS is set by the state.
Except for that one right there. I'm sorry. I should have spelled out Social Security in that bullet point. Sorry. But it is set by the state, so it's both the same thing.
What does that mean then when just a year, it's the last it was changed, but it doesn't say whether it's set by the state?
Well, look at the top. Is that the DNR licenses, those are set by the state, yeah. And within reason we're able to change them if the law allows. But if we change something, we're indicating the last time that we actually changed that fee. So DNR RV registration application process fee, the last time we changed that was this current calendar year, and the county clerk is not recommending an increase in 2011. So we're trying to get a track that if we do change something and we hadn't changed it for 10 years, there's probably a justification for it. If we just changed it last year, you know, the public only has so much patience for increasing fees, so you try to monitor that over time, and this helps us track without looking it up every single time when the last time was that we changed it or had an ability to change it if it was set by state statute.
But then everything with a year there is a state statute?
No. If it says SS, it says it's a state statute. If it's got a year, we would have to look up that individual.
So we don't know.
In this list, we'd have to go line item by line item.
That was my question.
Yeah,
thanks.
Sorry.
Andrea Richmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question, Steve, or maybe Gary. On page 4 for the land rent for Skipper Liner, I believe that was increased. It says it's for $1,000 in 2003, but there's no change in 2011. And I know County Board, I believe, approved that for
correct.
Water Place 1.
Yeah, I apologize. In preparing for this evening's meeting, I noticed a couple of things that need to be edited and corrected. That was one of them. In particular, solid waste. We've, along with the Public Works Committee, gone to, for example, a recommendation of a blended fee. That didn't end up in the schedule, so I apologize that there were a number of errors in this document, mm-hmm. Which is a good thing that's not attached to a resolution asking for your action, because we have to make sure that this is accurate, so I apologize for that.
Okay, thank you. That's all I had.
Any other questions?
Okay. I will touch also on that the other increase then, the major increases, in addition to indirect costs, register of deeds revenue is also interest on taxes. When we get to the treasurer's budget, we'll talk about that. We are experiencing some additional interest on outstanding taxes because when people go in arrears, they generally pay up because it's something that needs to happen before a property can be released or sold. It is generating, obviously, additional revenue for us, so about $110,000 that is helping overall property taxes. So that's the majority of the increases. There are slight increases in facilities and health that we'll walk through when this resolution comes back to you. Obviously, enterprise funds, we continue to push increased revenues where possible, Hillview and Lakeview, and of course the solid waste blended rate that I talked about should help to increase and moderate our impact in relation to other counties' tipping fees, but also should end up increasing some of our tonnages. Hank Cook and his staff have been looking very closely at what we can do to influence both the attractiveness of our rebate as well as moderating our tipping fees to try to attract more tonnage, and we think that the services and types of things that Hank and his folks are doing is attracting more tonnage and will end up putting us in a more positive position overall as we continue to moderate our fees to try to be competitive. So that's very positive. Now, the two items that I wanted to touch on that are getting a lot of discussion, one in particular in other counties that are not included in our recommendation, but I just wanted to keep reminding you of what your options are, is that a number of counties are redebating whether or not to do a wheel tax. Particularly, St. Croix County has had this for some time. Eau Claire County and the City of Eau Claire are redebating whether or not to do a wheel tax. It's an additional registration fee that counties, by their own authority, can put on vehicles within their county. Just to give you an idea of dollar amount, about a $10 charge would raise about $970,000 in La Crosse County. Again, I joke with Chuck that I'll wait till he makes the motion, but I have not recommended that. I just thought I'd point out that that is an option that's being debated more and more and shows the degree of difficulty that counties are having in paying for their roads and road systems, given that the property tax really is the only item other than state revenue. Now that I brought up Chuck's name, he's got to have a reaction. So, I think it was H no or something no or I don't know something.
I thought he said $10 wasn't enough.
Yeah.
How is that collected? Does the state collect it as part of the registration?
The state collects it, and it's administered by the state, and it's so it's very seamless from the county standpoint.
Okay.
I'm sure we'll get it back.
Well, my understanding of the county that does have it, and I believe Racine did it for a while, though they ended up unenacting it. Yes, that it was very positive, and that St. Croix is comfortable with that revenue stream, and it's helping them deal with road systems that they don't have adequate property tax base for. Again, I'm not recommending that, but I thought I'd remind you of one of the options, because there are few options that you have on being able to set your revenues other than property taxes, given the challenges. The last item I wanted to touch on, and I asked Greg Stengel to be here as well, is I ended up projecting this when we first reviewed, and it is not in your budget recommendation, but I think it's important to point out that another item that, and Don will probably debate with me on this, but the farmland preservation fee example is that counties do have the authority. Brown County's been doing this for about 4 years, is that what you said, Greg? Where because of the amount of time that county employees are spending helping farmers to actually qualify for farmland preservation and institute conservation practices, help give consulting services that only benefit those property owners, not generally the rest of the public except for in protecting water and environmental resources. It's the farmers that benefit from the farmland preservation. So, for example, in 2009, about 241 participants were in the program. 69,000 acres were enrolled in farmland preservation, which resulted in tax credits to those individual landowners of over 276,000, or an average credit of about 395. Now, the new Working Lands Initiative will nearly double that in this next calendar year to 750, up to an estimated 500,000. And as the budget sits before you, all we're doing is providing that out of the goodness of our heart in our land conservation budget without asking for an additional portion of that. Greg and his staff actually provide that direct work. They work directly with farmers to do that. In your budget before you is no additional increase in fee. You could always consider that again in 2012, but I know in talking with a couple of board members on executive committee, you wanted to know areas that maybe we had not identified to be aggressive on fees. I've identified those areas that we felt we could do without making huge changes here. This might be an area you would want to visit again for either 2011 or 2012, and all it's doing in essence is taking a portion of the gain that would only be there because our staff is actually doing the work for those in the farmland preservation. So again, that's a very quick overview. We will review line item by line item with the executive committee, and when this comes back to your budget, it's generally in the November meeting. There's a resolution based on the executive committee that then goes for debate and or amendment. That's my entire presentation, except there was one handout that was asked for on supervisor travel. I'll get back to that, but I see a question, Mr. Chair.
Rain Friedland.
Why is it that the a marriage license will be $45? It's up from $25, but domestic partnership declaration is $65. Why that difference?
They both were already at a different rate, and I don't recall how we set that last year, but that in working with the county clerk, she was trying to increase both of them equally. I don't recall the
Linda knows the answer.
The answer is because the state takes $20 of the marriage license fee for mediation, and they did not when they created the domestic partnership and gave it the same fee. They did not take $20 out of that fee for mediation like they do the marriage license.
Well, then doesn't that mean that the domestic partnership declaration should be less expensive than the marriage license?
It can't be. By state statute, it's supposed to be the same. Whatever the county charges for marriage license is what they have to charge for the domestic partnership.
But we're not.
But you're taking the money out of the marriage license, not the other way around.
The state statute specifies how much goes to the state and how much goes to the mediation, and the remainder stays with the county. But the state statute, when they created the domestic partnership, also states that whatever the full charge is for the marriage license is what the full charge will be for domestic partnership. So therefore, the county does get to keep $20 more on a domestic partnership than they do on a marriage license, but it's mandated by state statute and can't be done any other way.
Okay.
Okay.
Bill Feehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Administrator, my question is about the monitoring fees for the Justice Sanctions Program. And it lists the rates, and I'm curious, are these daily rates? Are these one-time rates? How are those rates charged? So it's the last page, 20.
Page 20. They're listed in the separate side there, one time per day. There's a column that lists how each one of them are charged, per bracelet, per cell unit.
Thank you.
I think Dunmeyer was next.
Steve O'Malley, how's a wheel tax determined? On a car, four wheels, or?
That's my understanding, is it's per car. Denny was here. No, he was here earlier. We were talking about that. As I understand it in St. Croix, the way that they're charging it is $10 per car, I believe.
So trailers aren't involved or anything like
no.
that?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Tina Weirs.
I have a question on page number 10, the concrete and masonry solid waste. It's a really large increase from $10 to $48 per ton, and I was just wondering if we could see why it's such an extreme increase.
Gary's got a comment.
Actually, this is one of the line items that needs to be adjusted. It's actually going to go from $10 up to $59, and I think maybe Hank could come in and explain the rationale on why we adjusted some of these solid waste numbers. Hank, could you come in, please?
And again, I apologize. There are a number of errors in solid waste, so a number of these are going to significantly change, but Hank is here to answer some of those questions. He's done a more thorough review of all of our fees in this area based on market, based on how to compete, and how to attract more waste.
Did you understand or hear the question, Hank?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
The concrete and the masonry used to be used as a road base in the landfill. It just isn't working out that way, and we're having to treat it as demolition that's occupying the same amount of space in the site as normal demolition. So that's how we're treating it.
Any other questions or comments? Okay.
Okay, the last item then, if you don't have any other questions on fees, is I can't recall who asked for it, but wanted a detailed breakdown of supervisor travel.
I think that was Mr. Sobranek.
Okay, I thought so. And included in that, obviously, and it's all public information, you should be aware that obviously 2010 is difficult to predict because there are some board members don't turn in their reimbursements as quickly as possible, so we don't know how accurate this year-to-date would be. I don't know who they are. But the fact is that the 2009 supervisor travel for taxable meals, meals and lodging, mileage and training were all well within budget. Chairman Doyle monitors who goes where and how and how he approves that. So while some supervisors have more travel than others because of their commitment to specific responses and responsibilities, Chairman Doyle's been making sure that this stays within budget, and that is true in 2009, and I would expect the same type of thing in 2010 as well. But we haven't done a year-to-date projection as much as we could because, again, many people are late in turning in their reimbursement requests, so it might not be as accurate.
But Jerry Sobranek.
We know in the rearview mirror that it's accurate.
Thank you. I've done this for a reason. The reason is I think we should give credit where credit is due. You can see just about all the supervisors have gone to conferences. There's no rules or anybody says you have to go to conferences. These people went on their own, probably for the same reason. I've been going to ITBIC since 2002 and only missed two meetings, and that's because of illness. Why do I do it? For the same reason I believe all these supervisors do it here, because they want to increase the quality of life. We want a good place, a county where you can live, work, and play, and have a good quality a life, which you can create and make La Crosse County a better place to live. Now, these figures don't reflect all the costs. Some people give up wages to attend these conferences because they think it's important. And the reason it's important that they would do this is that they can come back and help make La Crosse a better county. So I wanted, some of these figures are high. I would like to personally thank all these people for what they do and what they give up. This is only lodging, food, and travel. There's other expenses that they lose out of their own pocket money, like if they had to give up work, wages, or they had to shut their business down because they thought the conference was more important or whatever, and it goes on and on. But I just wanted to recognize all the supervisors for all they do.
Mr. Gary, you had your hand up, I think.
Is this just travel for that's in the county board budget? Let's say you're serving on a highway or some committee, and the committee pays for it, or the
no,
state?
No, if it's paid by the county, it comes through the county board budget.
Yep. Well, what if it's paid by the state or the federal? But it's run through our departments or something.
If it's paid by an association.
Oh.
If it's paid by an association, it doesn't pass through our budget. If it's an expenditure out of county resources, it all goes through the county board budget. That way, one person could be in charge of how that happens. Before, very early on when I got here, it was charged to various committees, and it was very difficult for department heads to know what a board member could go to or not. This allows you as a board and the board chair to actually monitor where folks are going. Most of that conference column, by the way, much of it is registration fees. So that's not compensation to individual board members. That's payment for a registration of the conference.
Right. I still didn't get that, but if a committee gets a federal or state grant and a member goes, does that show here or not show here?
That would not show here if it didn't go through.
It'd be tax money, but it'd be some other form other than county tax money.
I'm not aware of that happening very often, so I don't
know. Well, I didn't know. The other thing, kind of as an aside, that WCA conference, while I'm still thinking about, were we going to get somebody in here to talk about the economic, are we still getting that every third year?
I believe that it's coming back here in the third year, and coincidentally, I think we've got Mark O'Connell coming and visiting with us in November. Is that correct? So,
right.
At Supervisor Ebert's request, I think too. Yes.
Well, I used to hear that this was the second biggest convention that comes to La Crosse. I didn't know, so I thought maybe somebody from
we get it every.
When he comes down,
I think we have it in 2012.
It's us, the Dells, and Milwaukee are rotating it.
Yeah, right. But for La Crosse County, I thought it was the second biggest one that came into the city of La Crosse. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if somebody from the Convention Bureau maybe could sometime explain that
sure.
to us in the future.
Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments, Mr. Sobranek?
There's another point for Ralph that ITBIC, for example, none of those fees for our conferences or travel or anything goes through La Crosse County. The only cost is for our dues. All ITBIC expenses go through the WCA.
Anybody else? Questions or comments? All right. That gets us to cards and correspondence over there on the board. Suggestions for future agenda topics or announcements. Anybody have any of those? Mr. Menninger. I'm working on that. I sent an email to John Snyder today asking him if we could do it during the budget. So I'll let you know when I hear back from him. Right. Right. Yeah. Historically, we've tried to do that. It works really nice. And then we would have it available for any county employee at the same time. Yeah. And if you have the county health insurance, that would pay for it. Otherwise, it's cheap anyway. It's $4 or something, I think. Other announcements, questions, comments? All right, that gets us to Mr. Sobranek.
Thank you. There are things I don't understand. I'd like some answers. For example, why is it when I'm holding all the cards, everybody wants to play chess? With that, I move adjourned.
Moved by Mr. Sobranek, seconded by Bill Brockmiller. All in favor say aye. Opposed no. Carried unanimously. Good night.